this is a time-sensitive disease.
1 gram of vancomycin is not sufficient for the majority of patients.
We're looking for specific anatomic diagnosis of infection.
A little puzzled by that continued recommendation.
It may not actually and accurately estimate arterial blood or plasma glucose levels.
I'm worried about the handoff.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, joined by three other CCPEM hosts. It's great to have all four of us on yet another podcast. Peter, Rob, John, how are you doing this month?
I'm doing fine, thanks. We had a couple of wild tornadoes just the other day, but thankfully no lost lives, just some property damage and a few minor injuries.
Yeah, we saw the weather reports on the news and definitely looked horrific. Glad to hear that there were no fatalities. Rob, it sounds like it's pretty wet on the West Coast. How are things going?
Yeah, we're dealing with some flooding here, and we don't get snow days here in California, but my kids had 2 rain days, believe it or not, this week, and kind of crazy, but...
That's quite interesting, rain days. Well, John, I know that you're an hour north of me, and we had 60 to 70 degree weather today, and forecast for 4 to 5 inches of snow tomorrow.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm ready for it, but never fear, because a little bit of snow goes a long way up here. People start spontaneously combusting with just the slightest snow, so hopefully things will be all right.
I'm sure that the first flake falls in the morning, there'll be the phone call for schools. Schools closing in our area, so we'll see. Well, let's get to some EM critical care education, and hot off the press. Actually, it's not even on press. It's online at the moment, not due out in press until March of this year. But something that everybody is talking about, definitely going around social media. Lots of blog posts, podcasts on the new Surviving Sepsis campaign, or actually the 2016 update was recently released and published in Critical Care Medicine. So we're going to spend a few minutes on this podcast this month going over the updated recommendations, specifically highlighting where things are a little bit different from the last iteration, and that was in 2012. So guys, we got a little bit to talk about here. Now, overall, I think the document has, or what I've read, is to be about 90 recommendations, and absolutely we're not covering that during the course of our 20-25 minutes. But what we do want to focus on is some critical distinctions, what's changed, and then a few key areas that are pertinent both to emergency medicine and critical care. So to get things started, John, I'm going to turn to you. Now, the title of the article is International Guidelines for Management of Sepsis and Septic Shock. And I have to already point out, and something that we just covered at the end of our 2016 literature update on our prior podcast, and that's the sepsis 3 definitions. It seems like they've adopted those definitions within this current guideline. Would you agree?
Yeah, overall, I would agree. I think in general, the critical care community is largely moved to incorporating the new definitions. And to be honest, overall, I agree. I think it's important that we have a unified language in how we're approaching this. I can tell you how much of a struggle it is to go back and forth between the CMS recommendations, surviving sepsis recommendations. So I think having just a unified and consistent language is appropriate, which is what they look like they have done here.
Well, for those of you who don't recall our discussion, we'll direct you back to that podcast just from actually, well, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And the last article we discussed was the sepsis 3 definitions. But Peter, I'm going to turn to you for the first major area that's different in the 2016 guidelines from what we're currently operating under 2012. And for many of you, the 2012 recommendations, that initial resuscitation, we were really focused on a protocolized quantitative resuscitation strategy in patients who had sepsis-induced hypoperfusion. And we were targeting in those first 6 hours an adequate CVP, an adequate mean arterial pressure, good urine output, and an SCVO2 with the intent of normalizing lactate for patients who had tissue hypoperfusion. Are we remaining with those same targets here in 2016, or are things different?
So things are different. And so the 2016 recommendations, as with everything, we're going to start with resuscitation immediately, understanding that this is a time-sensitive disease. What's the level of evidence for that? Well, it's just a best practice statement. They also recommend at least 30 cc's per kilo of crystalloid fluid in the initial 3 hours of therapy for sepsis-induced hypoperfusion. Again, this is considered a strong recommendation with a low quality of evidence in support of it. Additional fluids should be guided by frequent assessment of hemodynamic status. So this has to be documented in your record. But again, the level of evidence supporting this is a best practice statement. They suggest dynamic over static variables to predict fluid responsiveness when available. And so this is a weak recommendation with a low quality of evidence. So they're talking here about passive leg raise and looking for fluid responsiveness. And again, so serial measurements and documentation in our record. They also recommend an initial target mean arterial blood pressure of 65 millimeters of mercury in patients with septic shock that require vasopressors. This is considered a strong recommendation with moderate quality of evidence in support of this measure. Now, one of the last things they do is they suggest guiding resuscitation to normalize the lactate in patients with elevated lactate levels as a marker of tissue hypoperfusion. Their level here is a weak recommendation based on low quality of evidence. But again, tied to this is a lactate elevation greater than 2 is abnormal and should be addressed.
So really some surprising recommendations right off the bat, and I'd have to assume that they're incorporating the 3 big sepsis trials evaluating early goal-directed therapy. In essence, the early goal-directed therapy protocolized resuscitation approach isn't included in the 2016 recommendations. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Rob, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this really marks the biggest change between the 2016-2012 recommendations, highlighting the move away from so-called early goal-directed therapy and to just getting that 30 cc's per kilo of fluid in right away. I think it's a good, solid practice recommendation. That's what we're doing in our shop, and I like to see that the experts are agreeing with that.
So, big things. Identify them early, give them fluids, frequently reassess using a dynamic variable for fluid responsiveness if they need more, target a MAPA 65, and goal normalized lactate. Rob, I'm going to stick with you on this next area. In terms of diagnosing sepsis, in the 2012 recommendations, they talk about getting cultures, but not preventing a significant delay with starting antibiotics. So ideally trying to get cultures, not taking longer than 45 minutes to the start of antimicrobials, trying to get 2 sets of cultures, so your aerobic, your anaerobic cultures, and then in terms of removing vascular lines, get them out when you can. What's the verbiage now with 2016? How has that changed? Do they still include that 45-minute cutoff window?
No, it's slightly changed. Their verbiage is that they recommend that appropriate routine microbiologic cultures, including blood cultures, be obtained for starting antibiotics in patients with suspected sepsis or septic shock if doing so results in no substantial delay in the start of antibiotics, giving us a little bit of leeway in terms of not having to flog a patient for those blood cultures if that's going to delay the institution of antibiotics. And that's a very rational recommendation. I think that you can argue about which patients do in fact need blood cultures. For example, your patient who's coming in with a standard cellulitis and may meet 1 or 2 sepsis criteria, not so sure that that patient would qualify for getting blood cultures being drawn, as well as patients who have a pretty clear pyelonephritis in whom we don't do blood cultures either. So we just rely on the urine cultures. So it's a pretty solid, broad guideline, not all that different than the 2012 recommendations.
All right, great points. John, I'm going to turn to you for probably the other sharpest contrast in between the 2016 and 2012 recommendations, and that's in the area of antimicrobial therapy. So many of you recall 2012 giving an IV antibiotic within the first hour for septic shock, a lesser recommendation for severe sepsis, using effective therapy with 1 or more drugs with activity against likely pathogens, assessing for daily de-escalation, using procalcitonin, and then empirically providing combined therapy for neutropenic patients with severe sepsis. What's different with respect to antimicrobial therapy recommendations in 2016?
There's an interesting change in the verbiage for 2016, and I think some of it's aimed at being a little bit more patient-centered in terms of the way we're dosing these antibiotics. But from a timing standpoint, they're still recommended to be given within 1 hour, but this time it was broadened to both sepsis, new definition of sepsis, which was the old severe sepsis, and septic shock. Now, this is interesting because a majority of the studies looking at the benefit of antimicrobials for patients in sepsis were in the septic shock group. So they've broadened it now to include the sepsis group as well, not just the shock group. And they give that a strong recommendation with a moderate quality of evidence. And they recommend essentially empiric broad spectrum therapy with two different antibiotics targeting both gram-positive, gram-negative organisms, but narrowing the antibiotics as soon as the sensitivities come back, which kind of makes sense. You know, it'd be interesting to know if this is routinely available at all hospitals, which is optimizing antibiotics based on pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic principles. Oftentimes, that's calculated and kind of decided upon by a clinical pharmacist. And I know these are becoming more available at all of our institutions, but certainly might not be something that's readily available for everyone. Next is empiric combination therapy, which we talked about for the most likely bacterial pathogen in septic shock patients, but against combination therapy for patients with neutropenic sepsis and bacteremia, the patient who comes in with being treated for their cancer and has routine neutropenia but looks well, recommending single agent therapy, usually my guess is cefepime at most places.
So those are actually some significant changes in terms of the timing for both groups now, optimizing for pharmacodynamics. And I found it interesting in reviewing the document, they specifically state 1 gram of vancomycin is not sufficient for the majority of patients.
Yes.
For 2.5-3 years.
Yeah, exactly. And then really the removal of combination therapy for neutropenic patients and the addition of combination therapy in patients with septic shocks, I think are some significant changes. Now, Peter, I'm going to turn back to you in terms of source control. Previous recommendations said that we really need to undertake source control within the first 12 hours, but understandably when it's available and safe for the patient, and then getting those intravascular catheters out. Is that still the recommendation to get it within the first 12 hours?
This is their recommendation that we look for it. We're looking for a specific anatomic diagnosis of infection that requires emergency control of the source. It should be identified or excluded as rapidly as possible. So not a time frame in patients with sepsis or septic shock. Any required source control intervention be implemented as soon as medically and logistically practical. And again, that's a best practice statement, no level of evidence associated with it. They also recommend prompt removal of intravascular access devices that are possible sources of sepsis or septic shock after other vascular access has been established. So again, we're not just pulling lines, we're establishing lines and then pulling the old lines that we think may be infected. And again, that's a best practice statement, no level of evidence in support of that.
I think that's a key pearl that you just mentioned, because so often all of us get those patients transferred in from skilled nursing facilities who have indwelling lines, could be a PICC line, whatever that may be. And if we can't locate a source in the lungs, the belly, the genitourinary system, we really need to think about that line and actually get it pulled even while the patient's in the ED. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. But again, when so many of these patients may require vasopressors and prompt fluid resuscitation, I would make sure that I had access before I pulled existing access.
Agreed. Well, Rob, let's get back to just a little bit on the fluid discussion. So Peter mentioned as the initial resuscitation, we're going to give 30 mLs per kilo of a crystalloid targeting within the first 3 hours. He mentioned dynamic over static variables. Let's get a little bit more specific with fluids. And the prior recommendations remained or had crystalloids as the initial fluid. No hydroxyethyl starches, consider albumin, perform an initial fluid challenge, and then in terms of assessing improvement based upon the results of that fluid challenge. What do they mention in the 2016 specifically regarding fluid therapy?
So there are some slight changes with regards to fluid therapy. They recommend that a fluid challenge technique be applied when fluid administration is continued, as long as hemodynamic factors continue to improve. That, again, there's not a lot of evidence behind that. That's just a general best practice statement. They continue to recommend crystalloids as the fluid of choice for initial resuscitation and subsequent volume replacement. That is a strong recommendation with moderate quality of evidence. And I think very important suggestions occur. They suggest that either balanced crystalloids or saline for fluid resuscitation, that you should really go with balanced crystalloids. And that's a weak recommendation, although we've discussed that in the past, and I would make that a strong recommendation. They continue to suggest albumin in addition to crystalloids for initial resuscitation and subsequent volume replacement when patients require substantial amounts of crystalloids, and that's a weak recommendation with low quality of evidence. They continue to recommend against head of starch, and that's a strong recommendation. So all in all, similar to the 2012 recommendations, with the notable shift to using balanced crystalloids when you are resuscitating a patient with continued volume. And a little puzzling that they continue to suggest albumin. We've discussed that topic in prior podcasts. And really, albumin has only been shown to benefit patients with cirrhosis, liver failure, SBP type situations, not really been shown to be a benefit over crystalloid in any other group that I know of. A little puzzled by that continued recommendation to consider albumin.
Agreed. Peter, any of your thoughts on albumin?
You know, I would just echo what Rob said. I think there are specific populations that benefit from this. To make it a general recommendation and then have the vagaries associated with when patients require substantial amounts of crystalloids. What's substantial? You know, because many of our listeners think 30 cc's per kilo is substantial, right? I'm fearful that this may raise poorly indicated utilization of albumin. And I don't think there's a level of evidence that really supports that.
John, let me get your thoughts on albumin, and then I'm going to stick with you in terms of vasopressor changes.
Yeah, so I'm not using albumin routinely. Exactly what Rob and Peter are saying. I'm sticking with either normal saline for my first 2 liters, and that's been studied, even just published this past year, first 2 liters of crystalloid being normal saline, followed by balanced crystalloid if needed, but hopefully we're moving on to vasopressors by that point.
Well, with respect to vasopressors, no changes in terms of recommending norepi as the first-line vasopressor, but some modifications regarding second-line agents. And what are those, John?
Absolutely. So in addition to norepi, if you have an escalating dose, it's now suggested to add, once again, either vasopressin up to 0.03 units per minute. And that's down a little bit. I think that was starting to be suggested of a 0.03 as opposed to 0.04 from the 2012 recommendations. The wording up to 0.03 does sometimes make one think of titratable, but I'm pretty sure that that should likely be a fixed dose. Or alternatively, epinephrine as a second-line vasopressor. Certainly I have some opinions about what indications to use either, but they're still mixed in terms of choosing either or vasopressin or epinephrine. It's good to see once again in the 2016 recommendations, again, we're moving away from using dopamine as an alternative agent to norepinephrine. There's still a suggestion that maybe in some patients there may be benefit, but for the most part, it looks like the recommendation has now gone to weak recommendation with a low quality of evidence, which is good to see. And specifically saying no low dose dopamine. So taking away that renal dose dopamine that we once were taught was a good thing. Now a strong recommendation with high quality evidence that we should not be using low dose dopamine. In terms of inotropes for cardiac support, they suggest using dobutamine as our first line inodilator if there's persistent hyperperfusion despite adequate fluid resuscitation and vasopressor use, but still a weak recommendation with low quality of evidence. Now, the last point, they suggest that all patients requiring vasopressors have an arterial catheter placed with a weak recommendation, a low quality of evidence. But they explicitly say this. And now I can say personally in my practice, I don't put A-lines in all my patients who I start on a low dose vasopressor. I don't know. What are you guys doing?
Peter?
You know, I like your practice, John, but I'm worried about the handoff is my concern. And, you know, as a patient gets a handoff to the ICU from the ED or from shift to shift, and the nurse is following recommendations to titrate that up, at what point in time is someone triggering that ART line? And I'd rather have the ART line in than not in. I don't think it's a have to be in the ED unless we're rapidly titrating agents and not at a low dose level. But I think if we're maintaining it in excess of 8 hours and we're titrating it at all upward, then we should be quickly going to an art line as our strongest measure of mean arterial blood pressure.
Rob, how about you?
I like the recommendations regarding the use of norepinephrine, of course, and I use vasopressin at 0.03 units per minute. I've been doing that as well. I like the dobutamine recommendation and the argument against low-dose dopamine. We haven't really done that for a long time. Regarding the ART line, I don't know. I'm somewhere in between. You get a lot of useful information from an ART line. You can do pulse pressure variation and helps you with other hemodynamic monitoring techniques. But nonetheless, I kind of view it, if it looks like the patient's on a moderate or low trajectory in terms of their sepsis, and I don't think that they're going to be in the unit for a long time on high-dose pressors, then I don't typically put in an ART line. Otherwise, I do.
I think in terms of my clinical practice, I don't require that I place an A-line to get vasopressor started, and we've talked about peripheral initiation of vasopressors or administration of vasopressors. But I think the longer patients are on it, I personally like a little closer monitoring and knowing that mean arterial pressure, minute to minute, beat to beat, in terms of patients when they're really on the sick end of the spectrum of being in shock and we're consistently providing them with vasoactive therapy. So more often than not, perhaps not every case. All right, guys, just a few more quick things, and then we're going to wrap up our reviewer update from the 2016 Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines. Peter, I'm going to turn to you for two topics. Let's just say fluids we've given, and we've used our dynamic variables, and we've initiated norepi and added vasopressin. But unfortunately, our target MAP is not achieved. So question number one, what's the latest on steroids? And then number two, in terms of older guidelines or 2012, when we're using that quantitative or protocolized resuscitation pathway, there was the inclusion of blood product transfusions. And where does the 2016 update come down on the triggers for transfusion threshold?
Okay, so both. So I'll hit with steroids first. So the latest recommendations, they suggest against IV hydrocortisone to treat septic shock patients if adequate fluid resuscitation and vasopressor therapy are able to restore hemodynamic stability. So before, they were saying, gosh, if you were using moderate to high level of vasopressors, you should be considering this. They're saying, no, if you're able to get mean arterial blood pressures to 65 with your fluids and vasopressors, you don't need it. If it's not achievable, they suggest IV hydrocortisone at a dose of 200 milligrams per day. So a mixed dosage, and it goes in over the day. This recommendation is a weak recommendation with a low quality of evidence. What they're really thinking of is that you've eked out all your endogenous steroids and you just need some help. And so who's going to need this? Those people who can't maintain their mean arterial blood pressure despite fluids and vasopressors. When we talk about blood and blood products, that's the mantra we've been singing. They recommend that red blood cell transfusion occur only when hemoglobin concentration decreases to under 7 grams per deciliter in patients in the absence of extenuating circumstances, such as not in the presence of MI, not in severe hypoxemia or acute hemorrhage. This is a strong recommendation with a high quality of evidence. So the number you need to know is 7. Again, the disqualifiers for that would be active MI, severe hypoxemia, or acute hemorrhage. And not just a little bit of bleeding, but hemorrhage, ongoing bleeding.
All right, Rob, in terms of mechanical ventilation, when we need to intubate the patient with sepsis, septic shock, I think we've talked a lot about the numbers overall in general and for critically ill patients, but where do the recommendations fall with ventilating the patient? What should we be setting the vent on?
There's not a whole lot new in the 2016 recommendations. They're going to recommend ARDS protocol type ventilatory parameters. Of course, a tidal volume of about 60 cc's per kilo, monitoring plateau pressures to maintain plateau pressures less than 30 or 35, using higher PEEP, using recruitment maneuvers, suggesting the use of prone ventilation, prone positioning for patients whose PF ratios are less than 150. And then I guess the really kind of the only new thing is extending that ARDS-NET protocol ventilation to patients who are septic and intubated, don't have ARDS. In other words, you're a patient who is intubated for other reasons and doesn't have full-blown ARDS, we should be using the same type of ventilatory parameters. Also, of course, maintaining the head of bed elevated between 30 and 45 degrees. We've been doing that for a long time. So really just the emphasis on ARDSnet type ventilation and extending those type of parameters to the patient, even if they do not have ARDS.
All right, John, bring us home. Wrap us up with the 2016 guidelines with respect to glucose target, and then when, if ever, should we consider bicarbonate for sepsis?
All right, so for glucose control, I think this is a number we're all familiar with, and that's the less than 180. So they're recommending a conservative strategy for hyperglycemia management. But this is an important one, I think often one that's left behind. As patients that put on an EpiDrip, they're a little less sensitive to their endogenous insulins. And this is more of a preventing some ongoing complications from prolonged hyperglycemia. So treating that sugar if it's greater than 180 after two consecutive finger sticks is now a strong recommendation with a high quality of evidence. And again, recommending the point of care testing of capillary blood. Just be careful because it may not actually and accurately estimate arterial blood or plasma glucose levels, which is a best practice statement. So just be aware of that, that it could overestimate based on the patient's peripheral perfusion. But again, the number being 180 that you're going to target. And lastly, in terms of bicarbonate use, the number that you want to remember is a pH of about 7.15. So with a lactic acidosis, again, allowing the patient to tolerate some degree of acidosis is just fine. We don't need to go flogging them to get a normal pH to correct their metabolic acidosis. That's a whole Pandora's box worth of a discussion, not worth getting into, but it's good to see that they suggest against using routine sodium bicarbonate therapy to attempt to change your vasopressor requirement if the pH is greater than 7.15. And that's a weak recommendation with moderate quality of evidence.
Outstanding discussion, gentlemen. This has been very timely. Lots of people are currently mulling over this update, major literature update here as we begin 2017. Your overall thoughts, you know, the key points that we pointed out in terms of our discussion, but Peter, any final thoughts on this newest set of guidelines?
You know, I think that it's the same thought that we're going to be aggressive early on with our fluids. I would just caution using too much normal saline and go with the balanced solutions. And then I would have liked to see them say earlier institution of vasopressors, kind of like even after 1 liter's in, clearly by the time 2 liters is in, which should be within 30 minutes, and then begin vasopressor therapy early.
Great point. Rob, what about you?
Yeah, I like the overall push towards really using hard evidence on these recommendations. And I like the fact that we've moved away from invasive monitoring in terms of central venous catheters and so forth. Overall, I think it's a nice balanced summary guideline. I think that the group has been very responsive to the acute changes in the literature. And overall, I think that just really paying attention to the principles of early fluid resuscitation, ARDSnet type protocol ventilation, early antibiotics, and all of those things that we've talked about.
John, final thoughts.
Absolutely. I agree with what everyone said. It looks like a lot of the randomized control studies that have been published over the past 4 years have been at least considered in these recommendations. So just to echo Peter's thoughts about early vasopressors, I know we've talked about this and probably hammered this time and time again, but early institution of vasopressors, even if they appear to be volume responsive, is a good thing. So while certainly we're going to attempt to give adequate resuscitation as the guidelines currently state, early vasopressors are important in my book as well. But again, I think overall, pretty pleased with the recommendations and the updates as well.
Gentlemen, thanks for an outstanding discussion. If any listeners out there have any comments or concerns or questions for that matter, please shoot us an email through the website. I'm sure that this is something that will continue to be discussed, especially as it gets printed next month in Critical Care Medicine. And undoubtedly, this will be a topic at the upcoming resuscitation conference at the end of March, beginning of April, at the Wynn and Encore in Las Vegas. So if you haven't signed up, there are a few remaining seats. And then once we get beyond resuscitation, we are certainly going to be turning our attention to a few local conferences here in Baltimore. And then Critical Points will be coming yet again next fall and holiday season. So be on the lookout for upcoming dates for those. Gentlemen, my thanks. stay safe in terms of all the weather out there with tornadoes in New Orleans, flooding out in San Francisco, and, well, spring turning into snow tomorrow morning here on the East Coast.
Stay warm.
Stay warm, and we will talk to everyone next podcast.